Roland pushed the two cops apart. They were both still alive. That was good. No matter how slow and unobservant they might be, they were gunslingers, men who had tried to help a stranger in trouble. He had no urge to kill his own. But he had done it before, hadn't he? Yes. Had not Alain himself, one of his sworn brothers, died under Roland's and Cuthbert's own smoking guns? Without taking his eyes from the clerk, he felt under the counter with the toe of Jack Mort's Gucci loafer. He felt the wallet. He kicked it. It came spinning out from underneath the counter on the clerk's side. Fat Johnny jumped and shrieked like a goosey girl who spies a mouse. His ass actually did lose contact with the wall for a moment, but the gunslinger overlooked it. He had no intention of putting a bullet in this man. He would throw the gun at him and poleaxe him with it before firing a shot. A gun as absurdly big as this would probably bring half the neighborhood. "Pick it up," the gunslinger said, slowly. Fat Johnny reached down, and as he grasped the wallet, he farted loudly and screamed. With faint amusement, the gunslinger realized he had mistaken the sound of his own fart for a gunshot, and his time of dying had come. When Fat Johnny stood up, he was blushing furiously. There was a large wet patch on the front of his pants. "Put the purse on the counter. Wallet, I mean." Fat Johnny did it. "Now the shells, Winchester 45s, and I want to see your hands every second."
"I have to reach into my pocket for my keys."
Roland nodded. As Fat Johnny first unlocked and then slid open the case with the stacked cartons of bullets inside, Roland cogitated. "Give me 4 boxes, he said at last. He could not imagine needing so many shells, but the temptation to have them was not to be denied. Fat Johnny put the boxes on the counter. Roland slid one of them open, still hardly able to believe it wasn't a joke or a sham. But they were bullets, all right. Clean, shining, unmarked, never fired, never reloaded. He held one up to the light for a moment, then put it back in the box. "Now take out a pair of those wristbands."
"Wristbands?"
The gunslinger consulted the Mortsopedia. "Handcuffs."
"Mister, I don't know what you want. The cash registers
do what I say, now."
"Christ, this ain't never gonna end,"
Fat Johnny's mind moaned. He opened another section of the counter and brought out a pair of cuffs. "Key?" Roland asked. Fat Johnny put the key to the cuffs on the counter. It made a small click. One of the unconscious cops made an abrupt snoring sound, and Johnny uttered a wee screech. "Turn around," the gunslinger said.
"You ain't gonna shoot me, are you? Say you ain't."
"Ain't," Roland said tonelessly. "As long as you turn around right now. If you don't do that, I will." Fat Johnny turned around, beginning to blubber.
Of course the guy said he wasn't going to, but the smell of a mob hit was getting too strong to ignore. He hadn't even been skimming that much.
His blubbers became choked wails.
"Please, mister, for my mother's sake, don't shoot me. My mother's old. She's blind. She's
cursed with a yellow gut sun," the gunslinger said, dourly. "Wrists together." Mewling, wet pants sticking to his crotch, Fat Johnny put them together. In a trice, the steel bracelets were locked in place. He had no idea how the spook had gotten over or around the counter so quickly. Nor did he want to know. "Stand there and look at the wall until I tell you it's all right to turn around. If you turn around before then, I'll kill you." Hope lighted Fat Johnny's mind. Maybe the guy didn't mean to hit him after all. Maybe the guy wasn't crazy, just insane.
"I won't. Swear to God. Swear before all of his saints. Swear before all his angels. Swear before all his arch—"
"I swear, if you don't shut up, I'll put a slug through your neck," the spook said. Fat Johnny shut up. It seemed to him that he stood facing the wall for an eternity. In truth, it was about 20 seconds. The gunslinger knelt, put the clerk's gun on the floor, took a quick look to make sure the maggot was being good, then rolled the other two onto their backs. Both were good and out, but not dangerously hurt, Roland judged. They were both breathing regularly. A little blood trickled from the ear of the one called Delavan, but that was all. He took another quick glance at the clerk, then unbuckled the gunslinger's gun belts and stripped them off.
Then he took off Mort's blue suit coat and buckled the belts on himself. They were the wrong guns, but it still felt good to be packing iron again. Damned good. Better than he would have believed. Two guns, one for Eddie and one for Odetta, when and if Odetta was ready for a gun. He put on Jack Mort's coat again, dropped two boxes of shells into the right pocket and two into the left. The coat, formerly impeccable, now bulged out of shape. He picked up the clerk's .357 mag and put the shells in his pants pocket. Then he tossed the gun across the room. When it hit the floor, Fat Johnny jumped, uttered another wee shriek, and squirted a little more warm water in his pants. The gunslinger stood up and told Fat Johnny to turn around. 10. When Fat Johnny got another look at the geek in the blue suit and the gold-rimmed glasses, his mouth fell open. For a moment, he felt an overwhelming certainty that the man who had come in here had become a ghost when Fat Johnny's back was turned. It seemed to Fat Johnny that through the man he could see a figure much more real, one of those legendary gunfighters they used to make movies and TV shows about when he was a kid, Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, Butch Cassidy, one of those guys. Then his vision cleared, and he realized what the crazy nut had done, taken the cop's guns and strapped them around his waist. With the suit and tie, the effect should have been ludicrous, but somehow it wasn't. The key to the wristbands is on the counter. When the posse men wake up, they'll free you. He took the wallet, opened it, and incredibly laid four $20 bills on the glass before stuffing the wallet back into his pocket. "For the ammunition," Roland said. "I've taken the bullets from your own gun. I intend to throw them away when I leave your store. I think that with an unloaded gun and no wallet, they may find it difficult to charge you with a crime." Fat Johnny gulped. For one of the few times in his life, he was speechless. "Now, where is the nearest..." Pause. "Nearest drugstore?" Fat Johnny suddenly understood, or thought he understood, everything. The guy was a junk ball, of course. That was the answer. No wonder he was so weird. Probably hopped up to the eyeballs. "There's one around the corner, half a block down 49th.
"If you're lying, I'll come back and put a bullet in your brain."
"I'm not lying," Fat Johnny cried. "I swear before God the Father. I swear before all the saints. I swear on my mother's..."
But then the door was swinging shut. Fat Johnny stood for a moment in utter silence, unable to believe the nut was gone. Then he walked as rapidly as he could around the counter and to the door. He turned his back to it and fumbled around until he was able to grasp and turn the lock. He fumbled some more until he had managed to shoot the bolt as well. Only then did he allow himself to slide slowly into a sitting position, gasping and moaning and swearing to God and all his saints and angels that he would go to St. Anthony's this very afternoon, as soon as one of those pigs woke up and let him out of these cuffs, as a matter of fact. He was going to make confession, do an act of contrition, and take communion. Fat Johnny Holden wanted to get right with God. This had just been too fucking close.
11. The setting sun became an arc over the western sea. It narrowed to a single bright line which seared Eddie's eyes. Looking at such a light for long could put a permanent burn on your retinas. This was just one of the many interesting facts you learned in school. Facts that helped you get a fulfilling job, like part-time bartender, and an interesting hobby, like the full-time search for street skag and the bucks with which to buy it. Eddie didn't stop looking. He didn't think it was going to matter much longer if he got eye-burned or not. He didn't beg the witch woman behind him. First, it wouldn't help. Second, begging would degrade him. He had lived a degrading life. He discovered that he had no wish to degrade himself further in the last few minutes of it. Minutes were all he had left now. That's all there would be before that bright line disappeared and the time of the lobstrosities came. He had ceased hoping that a miraculous change would bring Odetta back at the last moment, just as he ceased hoping that Detta would recognize that his death would almost certainly strand her in this world forever. He had believed until 15 minutes ago that she was bluffing. Now he knew better. "Well, it'll be better than strangling an inch at a time," he thought. But after seeing the loathsome lobster things night after night, he didn't really believe that was true. He hoped he would be able to die without screaming. He didn't think this would be possible, but he intended to try.
"They be coming for you, honky,"
Dedda screeched.
"Be coming any minute now. Gonna be the best dinner those daddies ever had."
It wasn't just a bluff. Odetta wasn't coming back, and the gunslinger wasn't either. This last hurt the most, somehow. He had been sure he and the gunslinger had become, well, partners, if not brothers, during their trek up the beach, and Roland would at least make an effort to stand by him. But Roland wasn't coming. Maybe it isn't that he doesn't want to come. Maybe he can't come. Maybe he's dead, killed by a security guard in a drugstore. Shit, that'd be a laugh. The world's last gunslinger killed by a rent-a-cop. Or maybe run over by a taxi. Maybe he's dead and the door's gone. Maybe that's why she's not running a bluff. Maybe there's no bluff to run.
"Gonna be any minute now,"
Dedda screamed. And then Eddie didn't have to worry about his retinas anymore, because that last bright slice of light disappeared, leaving only afterglow. He stared at the waves, the bright afterimage slowly fading from his eyes, and waited for the first of the lobstrosities to come rolling and tumbling out of the waves. 12. Eddie tried to turn his head to avoid the first one, but he was too slow. It ripped off a swatch of his face with one claw, splattering his left eye to jelly and revealing the bright gleam of bone in the twilight as it asked its questions, and the really bad woman laughed. "Stop it," Roland commanded himself. Thinking such thoughts is worse than helpless. It is a distraction, and it need not be. There may still be time. And there still was. Then, as Roland strode down 49th Street and Jack Mort's body, arms swinging, bullshooter's eyes fixed firmly upon the sign which read Drugs, oblivious to the stares he was getting and the way people swerved to avoid him, the sun was still up in Roland's world. Its lower rim would not touch the place where sea met sky for another 15 minutes or so. If Eddie's time of agony was to come, it was still ahead. The gunslinger did not know this for a fact, however. He only knew it was later over there than here, and while the sun should still be up over there, the assumption that time in this world and his own ran at the same speed might be a deadly one. Especially for Eddie, who would die the death of unimaginable horror that his mind nevertheless kept trying to imagine. The urge to look back, to see, was almost insurmountable. Yet he dared not, must not. The voice of Court interrupted the run of his thoughts sternly. "Control the things you can control, maggot. Let everything else take a flying fuck at you, and if you must go down with your guns blazing." Yes, but it was hard, very hard sometimes. He would have seen and understood why people were staring at him and then veering away if he had been a little less savagely fixed on finishing his work in this world as soon as he could and getting the hell out, but it would have changed nothing. He strode so rapidly toward the blue sign where, according to the Mortsopedia, he could get the Keflex stuff his body needed that Mort's suit coat flapped out behind him in spite of the heavy lead weighting in each pocket. The gun belts buckled across his hips were clearly revealed. He wore them not as their owners had, straight and neat, but as he wore his own, crisscross, low hung on his hips. To the shoppers, boppers, and hawkers on 49th, he looked much as he had looked to Fat Johnny, like a desperado. Roland reached Katz's drugstore and went in. 13. The gunslinger had known magicians, enchanters, and alchemists in his time. Some had been clever charlatans, some stupid fakes, in whom only people more stupid than they were themselves could believe. But there had never been a shortage of fools in the world, so even the stupid fakes survived. In fact, most actually thrived. And a small few, actually able to do those black things of which men whisper. Those few could call demons and the dead, could kill with a curse or heal with strange potions. One of these men had been a creature the gunslinger believed to be a demon himself, a creature that pretended to be a man and called itself Flag. He had seen him only briefly, and that had been near the end, as chaos and the final crash approached his land.
Hot on his heels had come two young men who looked desperate and yet grim, men named Dennis and Thomas. These three had crossed only a tiny part of what had been a confused and confusing time in the gunslinger's life. But he would never forget seeing Flagg change a man who had irritated him into a howling dog. He remembered that well enough. Then there had been the man in black. And there had been Martin. Martin, who had seduced his mother while his father was away. Martin, who had tried to author Roland's death, but had instead authored his early manhood. Martin, who he suspected he might meet again before he reached the tower. Or at it. This is only to say that his experience of magic and magicians had led him to expect something quite different than what he did find in Katz's drugstore. He had anticipated a dim, candlelit room full of bitter fumes, jars of unknown powders and liquids and filters, many covered with a thick layer of dust or spun about with a century's cobwebs. He had expected a man in a cowl, a man who might be dangerous. He saw people moving about inside through the transparent plate-glass windows as casually as they would in any shop, and believed they must be an illusion. They weren't. So, for a moment, the gunslinger merely stood inside the door, first amazed, then ironically amused. Here he was, in a world which struck him dumb with fresh wonders seemingly at every step. A world where carriages flew through the air and paper seemed as cheap as sand. And the newest wonder was simply that for these people, wonder had run out. Here, in a place of miracles, he saw only dull faces and plodding bodies. There were thousands of bottles, there were potions, there were filters, but the Mortsopedia identified most as quack remedies. Here was a salve that was supposed to restore fallen hair, but would not. There was a cream which promised to erase unsightly spots on the hands and arms, but lied. Here were cures for things that needed no curing, things to make your bowels run or stop them up, to make your teeth white and your hair black, things to make your breath smell better, as if you could not do that by chewing alder bark. No magic here, only trivialities. Although there was Astin, and a few other remedies which sounded as if they might be useful. But for the most part, Roland was appalled by the place. In a place that promised alchemy but dealt more in perfume than potion, was it any wonder that wonder had run out? But when he consulted the Mortsopedia again, he discovered that the truth of this place was not just in the things he was looking at. The potions that really worked were kept safely out of sight. One could only obtain these if you had a sorcerer's fiat. In this world, such sorcerers were called doctors, and they wrote their magic formulae on sheets of paper which the Mortsopedia called rexes. The gunslinger didn't know the word. He supposed he could have consulted further on the matter, but didn't bother. He knew what he needed, and a quick look into the Mortsopedia told him where in the store he could get it. He strode down one of the aisles toward a high counter with the words prescriptions filled over it. 14. The Katz who had opened Katz's pharmacy and soda fountain, sundries and notions for Mrs. and Misters on 49th Street in 1927 was long in his grave, and his only son looked ready for his own. Although he was only 46, he looked 20 years older. He was balding, yellow-skinned, and frail. He knew people said he looked like death on horseback, but none of them understood why. Take this crotch on the phone now, Mrs. Rathbun, ranting that she would sue him if he didn't fill a goddamn Valium prescription, and right now, right this very instant. What do you think, lady, I'm going to pour a stream of blue bombers through the phone? If he did, she would at least do him a favor and shut up. She would just tip the receiver up over her mouth and open wide. The thought raised a ghostly grin which revealed his sallow dentures. "You don't understand, Mrs. Rathbun," he interrupted, after he had listened to a minute, a full minute, timed it with the sweep second hand of his watch over raving. He would like just once to be able to say, "Stop shouting at me, you stupid crotch! Shout at your doctor! He's the one who got you hooked on that shit!" "Right. Damn quacks gave it out like it was bubblegum. And when they decided to cut off the supply, who got hit with the shit? The sawbones? Oh, no, he did.
What do you mean, I don't understand?
The voice in his ear was like an angry wasp buzzing in a jar.
I understand I do a lot of business at your tacky drugstore. I understand I've been a loyal customer all these years. I understand you'll have to speak to...
He glanced at the Crotch's Rolodex card through his half-glasses again.
Dr. Broomhaw, Mrs. Rathbun,
your prescription has expired. It's a federal crime to dispense Valium without a prescription. And it ought to be one to prescribe it in the first place, unless you're going to give the patient you're prescribing it for your unlisted number with it, that is, he thought.
It was an oversight,
the woman screamed. Now there was a raw edge of panic in her voice. Eddie would have recognized that tone at once. It was the call of the wild junk bird.
Then call him and ask him to rectify it, Cat said. He has my number.
Yes, they all had his number. That was precisely the trouble. He looked like a dying man at 46 because of the verschluggene doctors. And all I have to do to guarantee that the last thin edge of profit I am somehow holding on to in this place will melt away is tell a few of these junky bitches to go fuck themselves, that's all.
I can't call him, she screamed. Her voice drilled painfully into his ear. Him and his fag boyfriend are on vacation someplace, and no one will tell me where.
Katz felt acid seeping into his stomach. He had two ulcers, one healed, the other currently bleeding, and women like this bitch were the reason why. He closed his eyes. Thus he did not see his assistant stare at the man in the blue suit and the gold-rimmed glasses approaching the prescription counter, nor did he see Ralph, the fat old security guard. Katz paid the man a pittance, but still bitterly resented the expense. His father had never needed a security guard, but his father, God rot him, had lived in a time when New York had been a city instead of a toilet bowl, suddenly come up out of his usual dim daze and reach for the gun on his hip. He heard a woman scream, but thought it was because she had just discovered all the Revlon was on sale. He'd been forced to put the Revlon on sale because that Potts Dollance up the street was undercutting him. He was thinking of nothing but Dollance and this bitch on the phone as the gunslinger approached like fated doom, thinking of how wonderful the two of them would look naked, save for a coating of honey, and staked out over anthills in the burning desert sun. His and hers anthills, wonderful. He was thinking this was the worst it could get, the absolute worst. His father had been so determined that his only son follow in his footsteps that he had refused to pay for anything but a degree in pharmacology, and so he had followed in his father's footsteps. And God rot his father, for this was surely the lowest moment in a life that had been full of low moments, a life which had made him old before his time. This was the absolute nadir. Or so he thought, with his eyes closed.
If you come by, Mrs. Rathbun, I could give you a dozen 5-milligram Valium. Would that be all right? The man sees reason! Thank God the man sees reason!
And she hung up. Just like that. Not a word of thanks. But when she saw the walking rectum that called itself a doctor again, she would just about fall down and polish the tips of his Gucci loafers with her nose. She would give him a blowjob. She would miss the cats. His assistant said, in a voice that sounded strangely winded, I think we have a prob. There was another scream. It was followed by the crash of a gun, startling him so badly he thought for a moment his heart was simply going to utter one monstrous clap in his chest and then stop forever.
He opened his eyes and stared into the eyes of the gunslinger. Katz dropped his gaze and saw the pistol in the man's fist. He looked left and saw Ralph the guard nursing one hand and staring at the thief with eyes that seemed to be bugging out of his face. Ralph's own gun, the .38, which he had toted dutifully through 18 years as a police officer, and which he had only fired from the line of the 23rd Precinct's basement target range, he said he had drawn it twice in the line of duty, but who knew, was now a wreck in the corner.
"I want Keflex," the man with the bullshooter eyes said expressionlessly. "I want a lot. Now. And never mind the wrecks."
For a moment, Katz could only look at him, his mouth open, his heart struggling in his chest, his stomach a sickly, boiling pot of acid. Had he thought he had hit rock bottom? Had he really?
15.
"You don't understand," Katz managed at last.
His voice sounded strange to himself, and there was really nothing very odd about that, since his mouth felt like a flannel shirt and his tongue like a strip of cotton batting.
"There is no cocaine here. It is not a drug which is dispensed under any circum—"
"I did not say cocaine," the man in the blue suit and the gold-rimmed glasses said. "I said Keflex."
"That's what I thought you said," Katz almost told this crazy momza, and then decided that might provoke him. He had heard of drugstores getting held up for speed, for Benny's, for half a dozen other things, including Mrs. Rathbun's precious Valium, but he thought this might be the first penicillin robbery in history. The voice of his father, God rot the old bastard, told him to stop dithering and gawping and do something. But he could think of nothing to do. The man with the gun supplied him with something.
"Move," the man with the gun said. "I'm in a hurry."
How much do you want?" Katz asked. His eyes flicked momentarily over the robber's shoulder, and he saw something he could hardly believe. Not in this city, but it looked like it was happening anyway. Good luck? Katz actually has some good luck? That you could put in the Guinness Book of World Records.
"I don't know," the man with the gun said, "as much as you can put in a bag, a big bag."
And with no warning at all, he whirled, and the gun in his fist crashed again. A man bellowed. Plate glass blew onto the sidewalk and the street in a sparkle of shards and splinters. Several passing pedestrians were cut, but none seriously. Inside Katz's drugstore, women and not a few men screamed. The burglar alarm began its own hoarse bellow. The customers panicked and stampeded toward and out the door. The man with the gun turned back to Katz, and his expression had not changed at all. His face wore the same look of frightening but not inexhaustible patience that it had worn from the first.
"Do as I say, rapidly. I'm in a hurry."
Katz gulped.
"Yes, sir,"
he said. 16. The gunslinger had seen and admired the curved mirror in the upper left corner of the shop while he was still halfway to the counter behind which they kept the powerful potions. The creation of such a curved mirror was beyond the ability of any craftsman in his own world, as things were now, although there had been a time when such things, and many of the others he saw in Eddie and Odetta's world, might have been made. He had seen the remains of some in the tunnel under the mountains, and he had seen them in other places as well, relics as ancient and mysterious as the Druid stones that sometimes stood in the places where demons came. He also understood the mirror's purpose. He had been a bit late seeing the guards move. He was still discovering how disastrously the lenses Mort wore over his eyes restricted his peripheral vision, but he'd still time to turn and shoot the gun out of the guard's hand. It was a shot Roland thought as nothing more than routine, although he'd needed to hurry a little. The guard, however, had a different opinion. Ralph Lennox would swear to the end of his days that the guy had made an impossible shot, except maybe on those old kiddie western shows like Annie Oakley. Thanks to the mirror, which had obviously been placed where it was to detect thieves, Roland was quicker dealing with the other one. He had seen the alchemist's eyes flick up and over his shoulder for a moment, and the gunslinger's own eyes had immediately gone to the mirror. In it he saw a man in a leather jacket moving up the center aisle behind him. There was a long knife in his hand, and no doubt visions of glory in his head. The gunslinger turned and fired a single shot, dropping the gun to his hip, aware that he might miss with the first shot because of his unfamiliarity with this weapon, but unwilling to injure any of the customers standing frozen behind the would-be hero. Better to have to shoot twice from the hip, firing slugs that would do the job while traveling on an upward angle that would protect the bystanders, than to perhaps kill some lady whose only crime had been picking the wrong day to shop for perfume. The gun had been well cared for. Its aim was true. Remembering the podgy, under-exercised looks of the gunslingers he had taken these weapons from, it seemed that they cared better for the weapons they wore than for the weapons they were. It seemed a strange way to behave. But of course this was a strange world, and Roland could not judge. Had no time to judge, come to that. The shot was a good one, chopping through the man's knife at the base of the blade, leaving him holding nothing but the hilt. Roland stared evenly at the man in the leather coat, and something in his gaze must have made the would-be hero remember a pressing appointment elsewhere, for he whirled, dropped the remains of the knife, and joined the general exodus. Roland turned back and gave the alchemist his orders. Any more fucking around, and blood would flow. When the alchemist turned away, Roland tapped his bony shoulder blade with the barrel of the pistol. The man made a strangled yeek sound and turned back at once.
"Not you. You stay here. Let your apprentice do it."
"Who?"
"Him," The gunslinger gestured impatiently at the aide.
"What should I do, Mr. Katz?"
The remains of the aide's teenage acne stood out brilliantly on his white face.
"Do what he says, you putz. Fill the order. Keflex."
The aide went to one of the shelves behind the counter and picked up a bottle. "Turn it so I may see the words writ upon it," the gunslinger said. The aide did. Roland couldn't read it. Too many letters were not of his alphabet. He consulted the Mortzopedia. Keflex, it confirmed, and Roland realized even checking had been a stupid waste of time. He knew he couldn't read everything in this world, but these men didn't. How many pills in that bottle?
"Well, they're capsules, actually," the aide said nervously. "If it's a cylindrug in pill form you're interested in..."
"Never mind all that. How many doses?" The flustered aide looked at the bottle and almost dropped it.
200.
Roland felt much as he had when he discovered how much ammunition could be purchased in this world for a trivial sum. There had been 9 sample bottles of Keflex in the secret compartment of Enrico Balazar's medicine cabinet, 36 doses in all, and he had felt well again. If he couldn't kill the infection with 200 doses, it couldn't be killed. "Give it to me," the man in the blue suit said. The aide handed it over. The gunslinger pushed back the sleeve of his jacket, revealing Jack Mort's Rolex. "I have no money, but this may serve as adequate compensation. I hope so, anyway." He turned, nodded toward the guard, who was still sitting on the floor by his overturned stool and staring at the gunslinger with wide eyes, and then walked out. Simple as that. For 5 seconds there was no sound in the drugstore but the bray of the alarm, which was loud enough to blank out even the babble of the people on the street.
"God in heaven, Mr. Katz, what do we do now?"
the aide whispered. Katz picked up the watch and hefted it. Gold. Solid gold. He couldn't believe it. He had to believe it. Some madman walked in off the street, shot a gun out of his guard's hand, and a knife out of another's, all in order to obtain the most unlikely drug he could think of. Keflex. Maybe $60 worth of Keflex, for which he had paid with a $6,500 Rolex watch. "Do?" Katz asked. "Do? The first thing you do is put that wristwatch under the counter. You never saw it." He looked at Ralph. "Neither did you."
"No, sir," Ralph agreed immediately. "As long as I get my share when you sell it, I never saw that watch at all."
"They'll shoot him like a dog in the street," Katz said with unmistakable satisfaction. "Keflex. And the guy didn't even seem to have the sniffles,"
the aide said wonderingly. Chapter 4. The Drawing. 1. As the sun's bottom arc first touched the western sea in Roland's world, striking bright golden fire across the water to where Eddie lay trussed like a turkey, Officers O'Meara and Delavan were coming groggily back to consciousness in the world from which Eddie had been taken.
"Let me out of these cuffs, would you?"
Fat Johnny asked in a humble voice.
"Where is he?"
O'Meara asked thickly, and groped for his holster.
"Gone.
Holster, belt, bullets, gun. Gun."
"Oh, shit."
He began thinking of the questions that might be asked by the shits in the Department of Internal Affairs, guys who had learned all they knew about the streets from Jack Webb on Dragnet, and the monetary value of his lost gun suddenly became about as important to him as the population of Ireland, or the principal mineral deposits of Peru. He looked at Carl and saw Carl had also been stripped of his weapon.
"Oh, dear Jesus, bring on the clowns," O'Meara thought miserably,
and when Fat Johnny asked again if O'Meara would use the key on the counter to unlock the handcuffs, O'Meara said, "I oughta..." He paused because he'd been about to say, "I oughta shoot you in the guts instead," but he couldn't very well shoot Fat Johnny, could he? The guns here were chained down, and the geek in the gold-rimmed glasses, the geek who had seemed so much like a solid citizen, had taken his and Carl's as easily as O'Meara himself might take a pop gun from a kid. Instead of finishing, he got the key and unlocked the cuffs. He spotted the .357 Magnum, which Roland had kicked into the corner, and picked it up. It wouldn't fit in his holster, so he stuffed it in his belt.
"Hey, that's mine!"
Fat Johnny bleated.
"Yeah? You want it back?"
O'Meara had to speak slowly. His head really ached. At that moment, all he wanted to do was find Mr. Goldrim Specs and nail him to a handy wall with dull nails.
I hear they like fat guys like you up in Attica, Johnny. They got a saying, the bigger the cushion, the better the pushing. You sure you want it back?
Fat Johnny turned away without a word, but not before O'Meara had seen the tears welling in his eyes and the wet patch on his pants. He felt no pity.
Where is he?
Carl Delavan asked in a furry, buzzing voice.
He left, Fat Johnny said dully. That's all I know. He left. I thought he was going to kill me.
Delavan was getting slowly to his feet. He felt tacky wetness on the side of his face and looked at his fingers. Blood. Fuck. He groped for his gun and kept groping, groping and hoping, long after his fingers had assured him his gun and holster were gone. O'Meara merely had a headache. Delavan felt as if someone had used the inside of his head as a nuclear weapons testing site.
"Guy took my gun," he said to O'Meara.
His voice was so slurry the words were almost impossible to make out.
"Join the club."
"He's still here?"
Delavan took a step toward O'Meara, tilted to the left as if he were on the deck of a ship in a heavy sea, and then managed to right himself.
"No."
"How long?"
Delavan looked at Fat Johnny, who didn't answer, perhaps because Fat Johnny, whose back was turned, thought Delavan was still talking to his partner. Delavan, not a man noted for even temper and restrained behavior under the best of circumstances, roared at the man, even though it made his head feel like it was going to crack into 1,000 pieces.
"I asked you a question, you fat shit! How long has that motherfucker been gone?"
5 minutes, maybe, Fat Johnny said dully. "Took his shells and your guns."
He paused.
"Paid for the shells, I couldn't believe it."
5 minutes, Delavan thought. The guy had come in a cab. Sitting in their cruiser and drinking coffee, they had seen him get out of it. It was getting close to rush hour. Cabs were hard to get at this time of day. Maybe.
"Come on," he said to George O'Meara. "We still got a chance to collar him. We'll want a gun from this slut here."
O'Meara displayed the Magnum. At first, Delavan saw two of them. Then the image slowly came together.
"Good."
Delavan was coming around. Not all at once, but getting there, like a prize fighter who has taken a damned hard one on the chin.
"You keep it. I'll use a shotgun under the dash."
He started for the door, and this time he did more than reel. He staggered and had to claw the wall to keep his feet.
"You gonna be all right?" O'Meara asked.
"If we catch him," Delavan said. They left.
Fat Johnny was not as glad about their departure as he had been about that of the spook in the blue suit, but almost. Almost. 2. Delavan and O'Meara didn't even have to discuss which direction the perp might have taken when he left the gun shop. All they had to do was listen to the radio dispatcher. "Code 19, she said over and over again. "Robbery in progress, shots fired. Code 19, code 19, location is 395 West 49th. Katz's Drugs, perpetrator tall, sandy-haired, blue suit."
"Shots fired," Delavan thought, his head aching worse than ever. "I wonder if they were fired with George's gun or mine, or both. If that shitbag killed someone, we're fucked, unless we get him."
"Blast off," he said curtly to O'Meara, who didn't need to be told twice. He understood the situation as well as Delavan did. He flipped on the lights and the siren and screamed out into traffic. It was nodding up already, rush hour starting, and so O'Meara ran the cruiser with two wheels in the gutter and two on the sidewalk, scattering pedestrians like quail. He clipped the rear fender of a produce truck sliding onto 49th. Ahead he could see twinkling glass on the sidewalk. They could both hear the strident bray of the alarm. Pedestrians were sheltering in doorways and behind piles of garbage, but residents of the overhead apartments were staring out eagerly, as if this was a particularly good TV show or a movie you didn't have to pay to see. The block was devoid of automobile traffic. Cabs and commuters alike had scattered.
"I just hope he's still there," Delavan said, and used a key to unlock the short steel bars across the stock and barrel of the pump shotgun under the dashboard. He pulled it out of its clips. "I just hope that rotten crotch son of a bitch is still there."
What neither understood was that when you were dealing with the gunslinger, it was usually better to leave bad enough alone. 3. When Roland stepped out of Katz's Drugs, the big bottle of Keflex had joined the cartons of ammo in Jack Mort's coat pockets. He had Carl Delavan's Service 38 in his right hand. It felt so damned good to hold a gun in a whole right hand. He heard the siren and saw the car roaring down the street. "Them," he thought. He began to raise the gun,
and then remembered they were gunslingers, gunslingers doing their duty. He turned and went back into the alchemist shop.
"Hold it, motherfucker!"
Delavan screamed. Roland's eyes flew to the convex mirror in time to see one of the gunslingers, the one whose ear had bled, leaning out of the window with a scatter rifle. As his partner pulled their carriage to a screaming halt that made its rubber wheels smoke on the pavement, he jacked a shell into its chamber. Roland hit the floor. 4. Katz didn't need any mirror to see what was about to happen. First the crazy man, now the crazy cops. Oy vey.
"Drop!"
he screamed to his assistant and to Ralph, the security guard, and then fell to his knees behind the counter without waiting to see if they were doing the same or not. Then, a split second before Delavan triggered the shotgun, his assistant dropped on top of him like an eager tackle sacking the quarterback in a football game, driving Katz's head against the floor and breaking his jaw in two places. Through the sudden pain, which went roaring through his head, he heard the shotgun's blast, heard the remaining glass in the window shatter, along with bottles of aftershave, cologne, perfume, mouthwash, cough syrup, God knew what else. 1,000 conflicting smells rose, creating one hell stench. And before he passed out, Katz again called upon God to rot his father for chaining this curse of a drugstore to his ankle in the first place. 5. Roland saw bottles and boxes fly back in a hurricane of shot. A glass case containing timepieces disintegrated. Most of the watches inside also disintegrated. The pieces flew backwards in a sparkling cloud. "They can't know if there are still innocent people in here or not," he thought. "They can't know, and yet they used a scatter rifle just the same." It was unforgivable. He felt anger and suppressed it. They were gunslingers. Better to believe their brains had been addled by the head-knocking they'd taken than to believe they'd done such a thing knowingly, without a care for whom they might hurt or kill. They would expect him to either run or shoot. Instead, he crept forward, keeping low. He lacerated both hands and knees on shards of broken glass. The pain brought Jack Mort back to consciousness. He was glad Mort was back. He would need him. As for Mort's hands and knees, he didn't care. He could stand the pain easily, and the wounds were being inflicted on the body of a monster who deserved no better. He reached the area just under what remained of the plate glass window. He was to the right of the door. He crouched there, body coiled. He holstered the gun, which had been in his right hand. He would not need it. 6.
"What are you doing, Carl?"
O'Meara screamed. In his head, he suddenly saw a daily news headline, "Cop kills 4 in Westside Drugstore Snafu." Delavan ignored him and pumped a fresh shell into the shotgun. "Let's go get this shit." 7. It happened exactly as the gunslinger had hoped it would. Furious at being effortlessly fooled and disarmed by a man who probably looked to them no more dangerous than any of the other lambs on the streets of this seemingly endless city, still groggy from the head-knocking, they rushed in, with the idiot who had fired the scatter rifle in the lead. They ran slightly bent over, like soldiers charging an enemy position, but that was the only concession they made to the idea that their adversary might still be inside. In their minds, he was already out the back and fleeing down an alley. So they came crunching over the sidewalk glass, and when the gunslinger with the scatter rifle pulled open the glassless door and charged in, the gunslinger rose, his hands laced together in a single fist, and brought it down on the nape of Officer Carl Delavan's neck. While testifying before the investigating committee, Delavan would claim he remembered nothing at all after kneeling down in Clements and seeing the perp's wallet under the counter. The committee members thought such amnesia was, under the circumstances, pretty damned convenient, and Delavan was lucky to get off with a 60-day suspension without pay. Roland, however, would have believed, and, under different circumstances, if the fool hadn't discharged a scatter rifle into a store which might have been full of innocent people, for instance, even sympathized. When you got your skull busted twice in half an hour, a few scrambled brains were to be expected. As Delavan went down, suddenly as boneless as a sack of oats, Roland took the scatter rifle from his relaxing hands.
"Hold it!"
O'Meara screamed, his voice a mixture of anger and dismay. He was starting to raise Fat Johnny's magnum,
But it was as Roland had suspected. The gunslingers of this world were pitifully slow. He could have shot O'Meara 3 times, but there was no need. He simply swung the scatter gun in a strong, climbing arc. There was a flat smack as the stock connected with O'Meara's left cheek, the sound of a baseball bat connecting with a real steamer of a pitch. All at once, O'Meara's entire face, from the cheek on down, moved 2 inches to the right. It would take 3 operations and 4 steel pegs to put him together again. He stood there for a moment, unbelieving, and then his eyes rolled up the whites. His knees unhinged, and he collapsed. Roland stood in the doorway, oblivious to the approaching sirens. He broke the scatter rifle, then worked the pump action, ejecting all the fat red cartridges onto Delavan's body. That done, he dropped the gun itself onto Delavan. "You're a dangerous fool who should be sent west," he told the unconscious man. "You have forgotten the face of your father." He stepped over the body and walked to the gunslinger's carriage, which was still idling. He climbed in the door on the far side and slid behind the driving wheel. 8. "Can you drive this carriage?" he asked the screaming, gibbering thing that was Jack Mort. He got no coherent answer. Mort just went on screaming. The gunslinger recognized this as hysteria, but one which was not entirely genuine. Jack Mort was having hysterics on purpose, as a way of avoiding any conversation with this weird kidnapper. "Listen," the gunslinger told him. "I only have time to say this and everything else once. My time has grown very short. If you don't answer my question, I'm going to put your right thumb into your right eye. I'll jam it in as far as it will go, and then I'll pull your eyeball right out of your head and wipe it on the seat of this carriage like a booger. I can get along with one eye just fine. And after all, it isn't as if it were mine." He could no more have lied to Mort than Mort could have lied to him. The nature of their relationship was cold and reluctant on both their parts, yet it was much more intimate than the most passionate act of sexual intercourse would have been. This was, after all, not a joining of bodies, but the ultimate meeting of minds. He meant exactly what he said. And Mort knew it. The hysterics stopped abruptly. "I can drive it," Mort said. It was the first sensible communication Roland had gotten from Mort since he had arrived inside the man's head. "Then do it." "Where do you want me to go?" "Do you know a place called the Village?"
"Yes."
"Go there."
"Where in the Village?"
"For now, just drive."
"We'll be able to go faster if I use the siren."
"Fine, turn it on. Those flashing lights, too." For the first time since he had seized control of him, Roland pulled back a little and allowed Mort to take over. When Mort's head turned to inspect the dashboard of Delavan's and O'Meara's blue and white, Roland watched it turn but did not initiate the action. But if he had been a physical being instead of only his own disembodied ka, he would have been standing on the balls of his feet, ready to leap forward and take control again at the slightest sign of mutiny. There was none, though. This man had killed and maimed God knew how many innocent people, but he had no intention of losing one of his own precious eyes. He flicked switches, pulled a lever, and suddenly they were in motion. The siren whined, and the gunslinger saw red pulses of light kicking off the front of the carriage. "Drive fast," the gunslinger commanded grimly.